Good morning. Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm your host, Hugh LaFollette. On the show this morning, we'll be talking with Stanley Fish, Dean of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Illinois Chicago, and our topic will be deconstruction. Dean Fish, glad to have you with us.
Well, thank you, and I'm very happy to be here.
To get us going, perhaps you could begin by giving a brief description of what you take deconstruction to be.
Well, the only way I can give a brief description is to remind people that when Bob Newhart, the television comic, first came up, he was a stand-up comic with a single prop, a telephone. And what he would do, he would imagine himself talking to some historical person. And one time in a famous routine, the Sir Walter Raleigh routine, he's playing a minor official in the government of Elizabeth I, calling up Walter Raleigh, who's on his expedition in the Carolinas and in Virginia. And the conversation went something like this. Newhart says, "What's that, Walter? You haven't found the passage to India yet? No. Well, perhaps some gold? No gold yet? Well, Walter, we spent a lot of money on this expedition. Have you anything for us?" "What's that?" "You say there's something that grows out of the ground. It's a leaf. You pick it and then roll it, and then you put it in your mouth and light it on fire. Walter, have you been seeing the doctor that we sent out with the expedition?" Now, obviously, that routine, which is much funnier when Newhart does it, has as its subject the practice of smoking. This is a 1950s routine, by the way, which is an important point. And what Newhart is trying to do is take his audience back to the point before smoking became a habitual practice, one that just came along with the landscape and no one thought very much about it, and make his listeners aware of how bizarre the practice might seem in a world where it had not yet become a part of the scene, had not yet become naturalized. Now, that's what deconstruction does. It's a technique for taking what we now regard as obvious features of our daily life and trying to unpack them, trying to go back to the moment when they were first constructed, first put together on the scene, and before they became so ordinary and common that we made the mistake of forgetting that the practice had a social, historical origin. Now, of course, as I'm sure you've already thought, this deconstruction of the practice of smoking in the 1950s wouldn't play very well in the 1990s because history has altered the situation so that now everyone is aware of how odd and perhaps counterintuitive and indeed dangerous the practice of smoking is. But in the 1950s, that was a perfect illustration of what is intended by deconstruction, although, of course, it was before that word was ever heard, and I'm not trying to suggest that Bob Newhart was a deconstructionist.
Okay, that's very helpful. Well, you said that Newhart wasn't a deconstruction into deconstruction. So where did this idea of deconstructing our current practices begin?
Well, I think, again, it began centuries ago whenever anyone looked into commonly accepted practices which seemed to be coherent and seamless and then began to unravel the threads, as it were, or draw the curtain back. So that you could see that something that seemed innocent and inevitable wasn't either innocent or inevitable. It's a long-standing technique of analysis. Whenever a politician in the history of the world stood up and said, "We have all been told that we have to accept this situation and that there's no other way to do it, but I'm now going to show you that this is not so. That before these present practices were in place, we were able to deal quite well with these problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." So that whenever there's that effort to go behind what now passes for common wisdom and show the cracks in the facade, that's deconstruction. The name was given to a very philosophical version of that practice in the middle 60s. by a French philosopher named Jacques Derrida, and it became a technique for interrogating social and political practices that seemed monolithic and unavailable to challenge. And in deconstruction is a way of challenging a monolithic structure by showing, in a sense, that it is really built on sand.
To get a better sense of what deconstruction amounts to, let's look at a couple of practices. And these are ones that you discuss in a book of yours, very fascinating reading called There's No Such Thing as Free Speech, and It's a Good Thing Anyway. And one of the practices you mention is the practice of affirmative action.
Right.
How would a deconstructionist go in thinking about both affirmative action as a practice and the criticisms of affirmative action?
Well, I think affirmative action is, of course, as you know, a hot-button issue. And one of the things that's happened, though, I'd say in the last 30 years, is that those who are opposed to affirmative action have mounted their attack by using a set of abstractions, which are very powerful in our civil history, abstractions like fairness, merit, equal opportunity. Someone who was on the pro-affirmative action side and was interested in deconstructing the anti-affirmative action position would start taking apart notions like merit and fairness and equal opportunity and showing that they were not, as they were proclaimed to be, neutral, non-agenda principles, but rather that they were the names of principles that were not, rather the names of agendas that were not announcing themselves. So, for example, you might consider the notion of merit and explain, as some have tried to explain, that what now passes for merit is not merit in and of itself, but is rather merit as defined by a certain set of class interests. And therefore, the argument for merit really isn't an argument for merit, but is a nakedly political argument trying to disguise its origin. So you might go in that direction.
Okay, would there be a similar criticism that could be raised by your views of people who support affirmative action?
Absolutely, because let's say those who support affirmative action might use words, not so much the words of merit and fairness, but might, let's say, use words like diversity and tolerance. And the same interrogation or assault or unpacking could be mounted against those words. So let's take, for example, diversity. You could say, well, affirmative action proponents say that it's necessary for diversity, but they are not really for diversity because they would not want to include in their notion of diversity fundamentalist Christians. So that while they're certainly willing to argue for special privileges on the basis of diversity for African Americans and others, their arguments also exclude as many groups as they include, so that they're flying under a false color when they fly under the banner of diversity.
Let's use one more example, and then,
sure.
And then we'll sort of discuss the methodology. The other one is the issue of political correctness, often associated with the question of affirmative action.
Mm-hmm. Well, political correctness is a nice example of a manufactured entity. That is, you use the term, as do most people, as if it were actually a thing, as if there were somewhere in the country some political correctness central out of which people were marching and going to perform various acts in different parts of the country. Political correctness is the name given to a set of political agendas by the enemy of those agendas. Political correctness is something that was invented very cleverly, indeed brilliantly, by neoconservative polemicists in the late 80s and early 90s. Now, what the word suggests is that the opponent's views, the views that you label politically correct, are political views, whereas your views, the views that you would oppose to theirs, are not politically motivated at all, but are neutral, independent, abstract, etc. I would say that that's an impossible description of anyone's views, that everyone's views are political, that is, are in some sense underwritten by a desire for the world to be a certain way and an agenda designed to make the world a certain way. The accusation of political correctness is a political weapon used by people who do not want to acknowledge that they are themselves political and want to tar their enemies with the brush of the political. In other words, look, if someone on the right calls someone on the left who wishes, let's say, to institute assisted suicide as politically correct, or to mitigate the death penalty as politically correct, the assumption is that the death penalty, for example, as an agenda, has no political implications behind it, and only the people who are in favor of mitigating or abolishing the death penalty are on some kind of political trip. My response to that is that all of the combatants in any political or social dispute are on some political trip. So there's never a distinction or an opposition, and there couldn't be, between political correctness on the one hand and some other stance on the other hand. The opposition is always between different versions of political correctness, each of which is vying for the right not to be thought of as political.
All right. What's the relevance? What's the importance of this methodology? What does it give us that we didn't have before? What does it give to people who don't currently use it?
Well, I don't think it, as I said a few moments ago, I don't think it is something we didn't have before. I think we've always had this method of looking behind accepted routine matters of fact, as they were at least presented to society, and showing that they were not so routine that it wasn't necessary that they be accepted. I think the value of the technique, whether it's used by persons on the right or on the left, and both sides use it, the value of the technique is that it is a means of challenging settled practices which have become so familiar that we forget that there were alternatives to them and could be alternatives to them again if their stranglehold on the popular imagination were perhaps shaken. And it's the business of deconstructive analysis, again, whether used by the right or the left, to shake the foundations of that which seemed unshakable.
That certainly makes perfectly good sense. What I'd like to do, and maybe this is a good point to pause before we get into the second half of the show, this is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Stanley Fish, Dean of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Illinois Chicago, and our topic is deconstruction. You used a metaphor earlier that one of the things that the methodology of deconstruction does is it shows that all our views, I'm not quite sure the exact wording, but something like that our views are built on sand.
Right. If you assume that the only good views that anyone could have would be the ones that are built on eternal principles, that I think is a demand that cannot be met. But rhetorically and politically, a lot of people put forward their positions on the basis that they were built on eternal principles. And one of the political benefits of putting forward your position in that way is it suggests that the position is unchallengeable. Now, if deconstruction or the method of interrogation that goes along with deconstruction challenges a point of view on that basis, it challenges all points of view on that basis, because it says no point of view, no political perspective or agenda is based on eternal principles or timeless imperatives. All political agendas are rooted in local historical concerns. So that the sand that our views or agendas are built on is the sand and soil of human history. And so deconstruction's lesson is that underlying the sand and soil of human history is nothing. That is, there's nothing that supports it, so that we had better look to our local historical situations and work within them rather than going out to seek eternal, immutable, abstract principles that we shall never find.
All right, I'm wondering, I can imagine someone saying, look, there's a dichotomy you've drawn here between two options. One is looking for foundations on sand.
Right.
The other is to look for immutable principles, that is, principles that are somehow not tied at all to any individuals, any histories,
that's right,
any concerns.
Right. You've got that exactly right.
Are those the only options? I mean,
yes and no, because if you're someone who believes that only immutable principles or timeless principles will support a genuine practice, then, of course, you're not going to settle for anything else. My view is that in the absence of such immutable foundations, such foundations that are like the Rock of Gibraltar, we still have, and the foundations that come along with our everyday practices. And you can think of this in terms, let's say, of disciplines as far apart as literary study on the one hand and scientific practice on the other hand. In both cases, if you take the long historical view, you're able to see that in the history either of scientific inquiry or of literary criticism, the set of underlying principles is continually changing. That it is a history, as is the history of any discipline, of the successive dislodging or debunking of what a previous generation had thought to be absolutely certain. But so long as the structure of certainty is in place, it's perfectly reasonable to rely on it, to act within it, to determine goals within it. And then when the structure of certainty that has been around for a while is challenged and dethroned, as it almost always will be, it will be replaced by a new one, which will provide a new set of certainties. Now, for a lot of people, that's not enough, because what they hear me saying is that, well, that just means that you go from one unstable structure to another. And in a sense, that's true, although I would rephrase it. You go from one temporary structure of stability to another temporary structure of stability. And that, I think, is the way life is like.
All right. Let's think about this in very practical terms. I'm a member, and again, if I'm using the wrong language here, please feel free to correct
me. So far, you're doing really well.
I'm a member of some kind of practice, the practice of science,
law.
Let's say law, maybe of being a Christian believer, maybe being an atheist. I mean, it might be any number of things.
That was a very good example.
And now I find myself using the method of deconstruction to uncover and realize that the basis of my own beliefs are historically contingent. To use your metaphor, and maybe you want to slightly back off of that.
That's good. Historically contingent is better than built on sand. Let's switch to yours.
Okay. Now, what do I do? Someone raises questions about my practice. They say,
well, it depends what the practice is. For example, let's say you're a believing Christian or an Orthodox Jew or a pious adherent of the religion of Islam. In those instances, the discovery that your beliefs have a historical origin is not going to actually lead you necessarily to question them at all, because it's part of your religious tradition, whether you're Jewish or Christian or a member of the Islamic community, that the tenets of your faith did have a historical origin in the figures of Jesus or Muhammad or Abraham, but that is assumed to be a historical origin that was presided over by God or Jehovah or Allah or Christ. So the discovery that your views are contingent upon historical events doesn't necessarily in any way make those views tremble for you. Deconstruction and allied methods are usually used by people to attack other persons' views, not to undermine their own.
Is that necessarily a good thing? I mean, suppose I say to myself, gee, I want to make sure that my beliefs are... Okay, I'm not looking for certainty.
No. You should have finished that sentence.
I just want to preface by saying I'm not looking for certainty. I'm not looking for something that couldn't be questioned. But I want to make sure that my beliefs are as
firm.
I want to say more than that. I mean, firm involves unshakable. And I mean, I can think of periods in my own life when I've had unshakable beliefs or seemingly unshakable beliefs.
Right. That would be
different for me than claiming that somehow, in some historically contingent sense, they are not as justified, not as reasonable as they might have been otherwise.
Let me say, as a kind of shorthand, I think that the issue of justifying your beliefs is a false one. Beliefs are not something you can justify because they themselves set out the parameters within which justification can occur. One of the things I say that you cannot do with your beliefs is examine them. And you can't examine your beliefs because your beliefs are the furniture of your mind or consciousness. They are what you think with, and they are what you think within. So in a serious sense, you can't think about them because there's no part of your mind that isn't structured by belief. So when people say, how is it that we can confirm or justify our beliefs? My answer is, any mechanism that you might come up with for justifying someone your belief would in fact have to be a component of your belief already. Beliefs are never justified from the outside. They are self-justifying, and if they are truly beliefs and not just opinions, all of the evidence passes through them, and therefore no evidence could either confirm or disconfirm them.
Okay, so even within a tradition, okay, I mean, there are two different questions. One is you want to raise, the deconstruction raises the question whether one tradition can question another tradition in a way that requires appealing to some sort of certain structure. Okay.
Right.
Well, and we'll agree for the moment with the deconstruction that that won't work. What about within a tradition? I mean, traditions do evolve, and one of the things you mentioned is that you've got one set of beliefs, and those often get transmuted into another set of beliefs. Now,
right.
Is that just happenstance, or is there something like progress?
I think that's an excellent question. I think there is progress within traditions or practices, but not progress if you're thinking of some overarching perspective that is above history or waiting for you at the end of history. So it's always possible, again, whether in the practice of science or in the practice of law or in the practice of literary criticism, to look at the way in which a set of assumptions or notions of what would count as good evidence change. And you can then say that for the people who were involved in that practice, that change was experienced as going from one way of doing things to a better way of doing things. So progress is always possible, but as measured within the traditions of the practice. There's no way of measuring progress independently, that is, in and of itself, outside the traditions of historical practices.
Okay, but can you measure progress outside of the perspective of any particular historical practice?
That is, if you're not yourself embedded in it, or if you step back from it for a moment?
Okay.
You can, but it won't necessarily be the case that when you bring your findings to those who are working within it, that they will recognize and accept them. That is, you can always take a perspective on a practice other than the perspective the practice instantiates, but you cannot be sure that when you go to tell, let's say, some sect of fundamentalist Christians, well, you're just living out the mistake that was made thousands of years ago by so-and-so, that they're going to do anything but look at you and brand you an infidel. And an apostate, which in the context of their own history, you surely will be. You see, one of the reasons why deconstruction and other kinds, other related forms of thought are resisted so much today, is that they go against what I think of as the set of liberal assumptions that is more or less accepted by most people in our society. And among those assumptions, is the assumption that people embedded within different practices can talk to one another, perhaps reason together, and come to understand one another and live in harmony because we all share some common set of norms of rationality or civil deliberation. And what I am saying, and what others on my side of the street are saying, is that there is no such common set. There is no common set of norms, either norms of rationality or civility, that would enable people of deeply opposing beliefs, A, to appreciate one another, and B, to accept one another's existence cheerfully. This is the dream of liberal government, and I say in almost everything I ever write that this dream will never be realized.
Is there a difference between it being fully realized and being realized in part?
No, I don't believe in halfway measures. There's no such thing as realized in part. That is, I think it can be realized strategically. Let me explain that. There are certainly occasions, and you and I have both been involved in them, when we have decided as to not press a question that we feel deeply about, a question of opposition to someone else's views, because it would be politically inappropriate or pragmatically ineffectual. And so you enter into a temporary settlement. You decide to respect one another's views at the moment because it is, for good pragmatic reasons, the best thing that you can do. But that's just a temporary resolution. And in time, that coalition, that coming together of interests for a united political purpose, will in fact be challenged or will fade away when, let's say, the common danger that brought two opposing parties together for a short time is removed. And we see this unhappily in what's happened, let's say, since the fall of the communist monolith at the end of the 1980s. And what happened was that in a twinkling of an eye, it seemed that we went from 1989 back to 1917, and all of the old ethnic religious oppositions that had been pretty much stilled or covered over by the ice flow of ideological communism were released once again. And therefore we have all the troubles that we've seen in the last 20 years in Europe, rather the last 12 years in Europe and elsewhere.
Okay, we've just got about a minute left. I wonder if you could sort of summarize what you take the import of deconstruction to be and what you'd like the listener to take away with them today.
Well, I don't really think it has much import. I think that it has been a discussion in the context of philosophy, and it's only an accident that the word has become a fighting word in the so-called culture wars. If there hadn't been any culture wars, then deconstruction would have been like any other fairly esoteric term in academic philosophy. Again, the neoconservative right very skillfully used the word and suggested that anyone who believed in it was involved in the destruction of Western civilization. That is a mistake, but it is a mistake that took because of excellent publicity and large funding. So what I would like everybody to do, both on the pro and con side with respect to deconstruction, is, as they say in New York, forget about it.
All right. Thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking today with Stanley Fish, Dean of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Illinois Chicago. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.